Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you.
It was just revealed to me because we spent a good part in the last half hour speaking to Mrs. Ruth Lichtenstein and Hananya Kramer. It was just revealed to me that you have a role in the documentary they're showing on a Monday night in Brooklyn, Am I My Brother's Keeper, an original documentary film which talks about America and the Holocaust. Just a word from you on this topic. We don't realize, especially those of us who took a strong interest in this topic years ago, we don't realize how the next generation really has no clue about what was going on in this country during the Holocaust.
If you would read the studies, you'd be shocked. I mean, I hope I'm up for an Academy Award for my role in this film. But short of that, first of all, what Mrs. Lichtenstein has done in this, in the book that she wrote, everything is just really amazing. And I think that this is so critical, and I hope every family will take their children and to learn the lessons of what American Jewry didn't do, what they could and couldn't do, and what happened. You know, when they did a study in Europe recently, and they asked young people what Auschwitz was, including here in the United States, the majority didn't know.
Wow.
And this is, and unfortunately, I think if you ask our kids, they may know what Auschwitz is. They do not know the details of what really happened.
Yeah, no question about it. And that, by the way, folks, again, it's Monday night in Brooklyn, New York. You can call 718-WITNESS. And the film, I'm sure, will hit close to home. And, you know, it's funny, the comparison yesterday, Joe Loda was here. We're talking about how kids like mine have no clue what New York City was like more than 20 years ago. And they think it's like a science fiction horror story when they hear people like me talk about it. So, too, our kids are so comfortable, thank God, here in the United States. They don't have a clue that there was a time in history where the U.S. and you know, and its outreach to Jews around the world was not up to snuff, so to speak. So there's a lot of education that has to go on.
Made, and it was one of the messages from last week's dinner, when people have commented to me that they have nobody realized, and as you saw these really this condensed history in the 2 and 3 minute segments that were shown about how much we've done, how much progress we have made, how much older we got, but more importantly, is this is something that you can't take for granted, and if we don't train our next generation to be involved, to be shtadlanim, to understand how to work within the system and how to use it to the benefit of everyone. Because when I believe that what we do really benefits and is consistent with American interest and American democracy, which demands one thing of us, and that's involvement. Or else, don't complain about the results.
Right. If you don't care, don't come crying to me. All right, lots of news this week, like every week it seems. I'll start with a strange one, and that's the earthquakes in Israel. I mean, are you getting updates in terms of how the Israeli government is dealing with the emergency situations and the infrastructure problems as more and more of these minor earthquakes are taking place in the state of Israel?
Well, Israel, it does have a fault line, and a major fault along the rift, the Syria-Africa rift, and there are reports that perhaps in history Jerusalem was affected by a serious earthquake, as were many places in the world. So I don't think there's anything imminent for people to worry about, but the difference is that Israel convened immediately emergency services and cabinet members to address the issue and to take steps to assure that if, God forbid, there ever is a more serious earthquake, that they will be prepared.
And you know that eventually now Israeli scientists will become world-renowned for their knowledge of earthquakes.
and how to prevent them. They'll find an inoculation.
Exactly.
That works against
it. It's unbelievable. There's so much to be proud of. By the way, I apologize to those who resent when I give kudos to the New York Times, but you have to admit this headline was a good one. In quake-prone Israel, public is advised to take cover, this time outside. Which I thought was really clever, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. I agree with those who criticize you.
Thanks a lot. You didn't have my back on that one, huh? The mayor of Jerusalem is going to continue to be near Barakat. Any major winners and or losers from this week's election?
Well, I think Nir Barakat is probably the biggest winner, even though his percentage was pretty small. But the fact is that it was a hotly contested race, although less than half the people showed up to vote, which also says something. And Arab population largely boycotted the election. and then they complain again when you're not in it. You can't complain about the results.
Right.
Although the highest turnout, by the way, were in Israeli Arab communities, where it was 80 percentile, 86, 85. Tel Aviv was expected that Ron Hundayi would win, and in Ranana they brought back a former mayor who had served, I think, four terms before he went to the Jewish agency. So there are a lot of interesting results, and there's still, I think, in Beit Shemesh, hotly contested, where they're claiming irregularities.
So does anything about the Jerusalem election, I don't know, change the political landscape in terms of what's called the ultra-Orthodox community and its relationship with the with other residents of the city, or it's essentially the same at this point?
I would say it's essentially the same. People will say, well, Shas did not do as well. Shas claims a victory. Derry now is reorganizing Shas in a nationwide effort where he's dividing the country into sectors and telling people to call in with whatever complaints they have about Shas. I think the Shas-Lieberman marriage may be over, but so all the predictions, which really varied over the last couple of days, it's really unpredictable. It depends on the turnout and depends who votes. And in this case, I think even given the heavier turnout in some Haredi areas, the outcome, therefore, was somewhat surprising. It was touch and go until well into the night, into the morning.
There are some communities where certain people have actually stated that they would move out if certain groups won the election. I mean, we know that certain communities, I'm not going to name any names, I don't know enough about it, and I'm certainly not there. Certain communities have, you know, there have been rifts, there have been divides within communities. Is it possible now that because of the leadership that's been elected in certain areas, you'll have an even deeper rift, even more of a split where people will just say, I've had it, I'm getting out of here?
Well, that's not the solution to problems, is to pick up and leave. It has been done, and it was true when there were other tensions in communities because they have options. But I don't know that in the particular circumstances, I think, to what you're referring, what the outcome will be. But certainly the elections, the local elections, tend to arouse much deeper passions. And the involvement of Dolim and others, some whose names are used in vain, has intensified it. And then, of course, the attack on Rav Steinman, even though the guy was mentally disabled, it seems, and aren't stable, it's a wake-up call about some of the intensity of the comments that are made in the attacks.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. First of all, what have you heard about Rav Steinman's condition? And I guess if the perpetrator, you know, is somebody suffering from mental illness, then I guess we could stop the conversation right there. If it was politically motivated or somebody taking quote-unquote revenge, you know, in a sane state of affairs, I guess it'd be a lot more to talk about.
Yes, I mean, the first reports that I've seen is that he was mentally unstable. Anybody who knows Rav Steinman, I mean, I visited with him. He's an amazing, amazing person, aside from his godless and Torah and whatever, his involvement. He went out, not only pictured voting, but he was out in different communities. At his age, he's very frail. He hardly eats. And for him to be subjected to the kind of assault where he was brutally shaken, and is feeling now the aftermath of it physically, and doctors have examined him. They're not sure what damage was done, but I guess we'll know in time. But it's just a horrific thing even to think of.
Aside from the tension that is obvious, as you just said, if people are resorting to this type of thing, or if it comes to that, then obviously, it's a very tense situation. Is there anything else that we could learn from this episode? Anything else that we need to know about the situation? Or is it simply that it's just such that there are such extremes that are so, you know, hot under the collar about these issues that some people, unfortunately, will resort to these types of acts?
It's not about political activism. It's not about having intense feelings if it's over issues. When it gets over personalities, and when it devolves into the hands of extremists or becomes so divisive, then the issues are lost, number one. Number two, we create a climate that is intolerable. And the leadership now, in between the elections, has to take steps to try and contain it and to deal with it. And that means in every community. This is not for the federal government necessarily. I mean, I don't know. You can't legislate this. You have to do it in a way that, that gets the message out about what the limits are.
No question about that. All right. We see, again, that the United States has been accused. We see what France did this week, in addition to what they said this week. We see the reaction of Angela Merkel in regard to the a possibility that United States intelligence actually has her cell phone bugged. Is the United States ever going to be able to get over this reputation that has emerged from the Snowden affair that they are spying on everybody, including their friends around the world?
I think this is very damaging. I think it's going to have long-term consequences. I think it's feeds on suspicions and tensions that have been building. From what I understand, Merkel's reaction was extremely strong. I don't know if it's accurate, but I was told that she said you had a choice between being the leader of the free world or of the Stasi. Remember the East German police? She said, I grew up under them, and you chose their way.
Wow.
I don't know that it's true. I know that she was extremely angry. Now they say that 35 heads of state may have been personally surveilled, which would, of course, damage our relationships across the board. There have been many protests and calls from heads of state to the White House about it. I think we have a lot of explaining. And I think we have to understand that sometimes it's necessary. This is the surveillance, as when the complaints against the NYPD for its surveillance or against other law enforcement, you're dealing in asymmetric wars. You're dealing with groups that do not fight by normal standards. The interception of phone calls or things are sometimes necessary, but they have to be with some limit. You don't take the phone calls of intercept the phone calls of the Chancellor of Germany or the President of France. They're not engaged in terrorist activities. We may want to know what they're thinking, but, you know, we could read a newspaper. So I think that this is a very serious development, and it just exacerbates the standing in the United States. What we saw Saudi Arabia do this week, I think, fits into that, where just, you know, one assault after another that seems to portray the United States as losing friends and weakening our international posture.
Yeah, no question. By the way, according to that article, I believe it was in The Guardian, more than 70 million phone conversations were listened to by the NSA in 1 month. That's from the leaked NSA.
But that wasn't just on Merkel's phone.
No, I understand.
She makes a lot of calls, not that.
But what I was going to say was, boy, if all those were potential terrorists, we're really in for it, because that's quite a large number. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmandtheam.org. Tzarev Shabbos Parshas Chayesara. Both Malcolm and I would rather be in Hebron. We'll hopefully have a report from Hebron later on. By the way, you know how you keep telling us that the Iranian president is the same as his predecessor, Ahmadinejad? I read an article this morning, Malcolm, where it says that the brand new president of Iran has suggested that the country's famed Death to America slogan be banned as the government has begun taking steps to reestablish relations with the West. So you see that Hassan Rouhani is not as bad as you thought. He's getting rid of the Death to America slogan.
And he participated in an event a week before the election in which they had missiles that said, death to the United States, death to Israel. In fact, there is a major debate about legislating that every rally, public gathering, has to have signs that say, death to the United States.
Wow.
Or as they say when we translate it, we say, down with the United States. But the actual translation is death to the United States. This is the debate in Iran. This is the country with which we are now talking and thinking that somehow this is, you know, that we're going to be able to change them, we're going to be able to moderate them. And the fact is that if you look at the record just of this last week of the involvement of Rouhani, and there's another book, by the way, coming out about his tenure, which just, again, reinforces how he boasts of using the time, the timeout, the suspension during the 2003 of enrichment to build up the system. And he said that the Iran's agreement to suspend enabled it to make more progress on the technology, and saying if it had resigned, it would not have been able to make the technological progress, because it wouldn't have gotten the material and information from the European Union that it got by as a result of the agreements. And he said that any suspension of uranium enrichment shouldn't last long. They also announced yesterday that they're going to start uranium dioxide processes in the next 3 months, which is an additional component which they say they need for the Bushehr nuclear reactor, but it's further evidence that they're not stepping back. We expect the expert talks next week, and then they're going to be P5+1, and then another round of expert talks. This is exactly what they want to do. They want to delay. In the meantime, there's talk that the United States will release $12 billion in held-up funds, and then the Europeans will do $35 billion. We hold about $50 billion altogether. And yesterday, members of the staffs of key members of Congress were called to the White House, where they were told to hold off, that the administration doesn't want the next round of sanctions. Many members, including Chuck Schumer and others, have come out for the next round of sanctions.
But they thought that was the group that said that it would hurt Israel. If the am I confusing two different stories?
Different story.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So what their argument is that if you suspend, it hurts Rouhani's ability to negotiate. That the truth is the reverse, that it is the pressure on Rouhani and on the Syrian economy that gives him the leeway to come into the negotiations, because people are hurting him, because they know that there's no way out. You release, you know, tens of billions of dollars, it takes the pressure off of them. And the Russians yesterday revealed that the Iran and the West may agree to 5% enrichment. And let me just take 1 second why this is no longer significant, as they say they won't enrich, let's say, to 20%. Because with the new centrifuges they have in place, you don't need to go to 20%. You can go from 5%, the process can go directly. You used to have to go in stages. This goes much faster directly. And the estimates now that the top experts, David Albright, others came out with yesterday, is that they could build a bomb in a month, And the White House, as I said, is pushing to hold up sanctions. We should be pushing to expedite the sanctions, to increase the pressure on them. And the Russia and Iran are talking about expanding military cooperation, so we know where the Russians are at and how they exploit every situation. And the idea that we do anything before, I know Ben Rhodes from the National Security Council said that there would be no front-loaded concessions, that we would only do it at the, you know, after there's real progress and real signs. I know that Bibi and Kerry discussed this. You know, they had a 7-hour meeting in Italy about the peace negotiations and about Iran. But there clearly are still differences. And as Stein had said, it's not a time to give Iran extra oxygen. We see what they're doing. We see what's happening with Assad, that the radicals, the extremes are gaining, that Hamas and the Palestinian Authority now trying to get back in Abbas's good grace, because they see him as emerging out of this as a winner.
All right. Yeah. So let me straighten this out. So the Schumer reaction was what? That was a reaction to a potential sanctions vote in the Congress?
No, this is about the support for the new sanctions bill.
They're directly against.
It's very critical, but it's really through Johnson, because this goes through the Banking Committee, not through the Foreign Affairs Committee.
And that's directly against Iran.
This is strictly against Iran.
And I'm referring to this story. A bipartisan group of 50 senators warned U.S. President Obama they will not ratify the U.N. arms trade treaty signed last month by John Kerry. The lawmakers signed on to a letter this week that expressed concern that ratifying the treaty could limit America's ability to provide military aid to Israel. Mr. Honlein, true or false?
I mean, there are people who have said it. Anything can be interpreted whichever way they want to try and put pressure. I don't think the United States has any interest in signing anything that limits their ability to help Israel. Unfortunately, the sequestration and cuts in funding may cut aid to Israel significantly, you know, another 10% or so this year. But I don't think that this was certainly was not intended in that way.
And in Israel, Ambassador Gould reassured Israelis that Britain would not compromise on Israel's security. This was in a speech he delivered on Thursday. This is in reaction to the speculation that Britain and France are ready to cave in a bit on sanctions to Iran?
Right. and the remarks of the Prime Minister directed both at the French and British, he's been calling them. But and the reason why people are concerned is something that Einat Wolf, a former member of Knesset, told about something she heard from the former Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, of the United Kingdom, who was for a long time the Foreign Minister, essentially the equivalent of being the Foreign Minister. And he launched a vicious attack at a conference, and he attacked Jewish organizations, ours, AIPAC, and others, that these are used to get unlimited funds to control and divert American policy, and that Germany's obsession with defending Israel were the problems and underlying the problems in the Middle East. And this at a European Monitoring Center on racism and xenophobia working group, which defines these kind of comments as... where they attack Jews as a collective. This is a former foreign minister of not long ago of the of England. So, you know, the protestations are not always matched by the facts on the ground, and we see that the West is just chomping at the bit to try and relieve these tensions.
But what's remarkable to me is that a week or two ago was different. It seemed like they had real, you know, they had real teeth in the matter, and they weren't going to budge on this. And now all of
they haven't budged yet. So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But the reports and the word that's out in a lot of circles, and that has a tendency to feed on itself, to build on it.
But why is this days at a time, the peaks and valleys of the attitude toward Iran? Like, why? It's ever-changing. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the reporting on it, but also the signals that are being sent. One of the reasons Saudi Arabia did what it did is, or primary reason, is because they see the lack of action by the UN, by the West, the lack of resolve dealing with Iran. And it's not just their... the nuclear program, it's the execution since Rouhani took power of 250 people, is almost 700 altogether. I mean, just on every front, the increased support of terrorism, the actions against Saudi Arabia in their eastern province. I know what they're doing with the Houthis in Yemen. I mean, they're instigating and supporting, and now the feeling is that they will be a victor if Assad survives. You know, this was the 30th anniversary of the bombings in Lebanon that took 241 U.S. servicemen.
Right.
The guy who executed the order on this is the new defense minister of Iran. Brigadier General Hossein Dakhnian, I think his name was. He was the commander of the IRGC in Lebanon at the time of the bombings. And this is the guy who's defense minister, and we're told that this is a more moderate regime.
Reason enough for the U.S. to continue having nothing to do with Iran. I don't have a credit on this story, so I'll first have to ask you if it's true what the senior Israeli official said, and then if it is, you'll tell us why on earth he would say this publicly. A senior Israeli official says the country will announce new plans for West Bank settlement construction in the coming months. Thursday's statement comes a day after Prime Minister Netanyahu held a lengthy meeting in Rome with Secretary of State Kerry. The two discussed the status of recently restarted peace talk. So if in fact it's true, it's something that maybe would have been better to keep quiet at this time.
You know, that's a contradiction in terms, Israeli minister keeping quiet. Actually, the prime minister has kept pretty good discipline. And what they're talking about is that there's going to be an announcement of another release of prisoners, and at the same time, there will be an announcement of tenders for construction. Remember, construction in Jerusalem, for instance, has been frozen.
Right.
And so this would be about tenders. This is not about construction, actual construction. It's just the beginning of the process, which can last for years. And it's meant, I guess, to offset or soften the blow of the release of the prisoners. And the statement now may have been because of the discussions in Rome or the feeling that Kerry is putting on pressure or something, which there's no evidence yet. We don't have the reports to indicate that that's true. Clearly, there are differences between the United States and Israel, but on many of the issues, on many of the bridging proposals, we understand that there is mutual understanding, at least. On other issues, there isn't.
Is there a strong opposition in the Israeli government, cabinet, Knesset, to this type of prisoner release? I mean, are we going to see the type of outrage we saw last time when Israel decided to release prisoners?
I don't know if you have the same outrage within the government as you had last time, because the agreement was voted, but are there people there who strongly oppose it? Certainly, and they have made themselves very vocal on it.
Yeah, but it's, right, but it needs to be a large group for it to become like a national issue at this point, right? Otherwise, it'll just.
I mean, there is national opposition, and especially because of the uptick in some of the violence on the West Bank with the attacks, and the debate now is that are they coordinated? Are they not coordinated? Some say it's the acts of individuals. Some of the security agencies say, or other people assert otherwise. So that adds to the concern and some of the recidivism that Israel's already had to deal with guys who were released earlier. So it's always subject to debate.
How long was the Kerry meeting with Netanyahu?
7 hours.
And there was nobody from the PA there, correct?
No.
So
he met with the PA separately.
So, I mean, the content of that meeting is Netanyahu saying to Kerry how many times that he doesn't have a reliable peace partner and that he's made every overture possible to try to get to the peace table. I mean,
I think he stutters.
It must be, because I just I don't know how many more times the leader of Israel can convey to the Secretary of State that until there is some type of direct negotiations and trying to work out a compromise, you know, Israel can't go any further with what they've offered at this point.
Well, there are proposals about bridging proposals. There's a lot of concern that Abbas is under dual pressures. One is from those who don't want to see him move ahead in the process, and internally it is unpopular in amongst a lot of the Palestinians. And on the other hand, he knows that he loses whatever little international support they have, and that you know, he doesn't want to be the guy to make concessions on the one hand, but on the other hand, he knows that if, in fact, the talks break down, he says it will lead to an intifada, but the intifada won't be just against Israel. It's going to be against him. So he has an incentive, essentially, to be part of the process and to continue the negotiations. But the constant threats of pulling out, in fact, backfire because it creates additional pressure within the Palestinian Authority. So you see the talk now of demanding that he appoint a successor, and what I said about his flirtations with Assad. These are not coming out of positions of strength, and Hamas obviously has been very weakened. So the discussions, I think, in this regard, deal with bridging proposals, coming up with ideas, let's say, to deal with the issue that's been very public of Israeli troops along the Jordan border,
right,
which Jordan insists on, too.
Can I give you some good news?
That would be nice. Yes, give us good news.
73-year-old Tom Jones, tomorrow night and Monday night in Israel. And you know why this is significant. He was under tremendous pressure not to perform in Israel.
And many, and several others also who have decided to go, but Tom Jones was one. There's another woman singer. Unfortunately, I'm not that familiar with him. But it means a lot to the Israelis, and it means a lot. But we see that this campaign of boycotts is expanding again. There are a lot of pressures from the Pink Floyd type guys who are campaigning to keep people out of Israel, to boycott Israel. The BDS movement, which we've talked about for a long time, and I know people still don't necessarily take seriously, continues to grow. It is a serious matter.
Let's tweet that out, guys. Malcolm's reference to the Pink Floyd type guys. I like that.
And what's his name? Waters.
And anybody out there who
I don't remember if it's Pink Waters or Pink Floyd, or his name is Waters.
Roger Waters, maybe.
Roger Waters.
Could that be Malcolm?
That's who it is.
By the way, everybody, don't bother Malcolm for Tom Jones tickets. He already told me he has none, so he cannot help you with that. A good idea or bad idea, Malcolm Honlein, for a major Jewish philanthropist to offer advice about dropping an atomic bomb on Iran?
Well, unfortunately, it gets, you know, distorted. He made the comment about what he was essentially saying is send a signal that we're tough, we mean business. I don't think he necessarily meant it literally. And say, you know, he said send it into a desert area, not into a populated area. He didn't say bomb Tehran. He said send a nuclear bomb there and say to them, guys, you either negotiate with us, because the feeling on a lot of parts, and we hear it, you know, in the Arab world, which has come in Israel, seem to be on the same page on a lot of this stuff, that you have to send a tough message and messages of weakness. If they don't believe the military threat is credible. So I think that he didn't mean it literally.
Yeah, and by the way, just and to his credit, as you say, he spoke about doing it in an area where no civilians would be hurt, and I think that the point was made. It may have been exaggerated a bit on purpose, but
there
point
were people
was made.
Who want to exploit him. And
well, these days, it's six words that get publicity. You know, nobody's looking for explanations or Rashi about different statements. You know, you make the quote, and that's what happened. And by the way, again, nothing against Mr. Adelson. I think what you said is correct. But all of us need to learn a lesson that it's those little sound bites now that are going to make news. You got to be really careful about having things being taken out of context.
He's not a political analyst or a political leader. But again, even though his words shouldn't be weighed in that same way as you'd think of somebody who's responsible for policy on this, you're absolutely right. People have to be careful, and things get taken out of context, or you got to know about what the consequences of what you say will be.
Egypt is looking to Russia to supply it with arms now that the U.S. has frozen much of its military aid to the Egyptians. First of all, you would not have made that recommendation. Right? I think we've determined that in previous weeks. You're not sure it was the smartest thing to cut aid to Egypt from the U.S.
I warned that they would go to Russia, if you remember.
Right. So now Russia's going to... Are they, in fact, going to come in and be the savior for them?
They could well. I mean, I don't believe that Egypt wants to go back to using Russian weapons and having to transform, the systems. And it's hard to integrate Russian and American weapons and things that we've held off on. So helicopters, they might, but start with Russian MiGs again. It's not such an easy thing, but I think the threat is credible. And what I heard also is that al-Sisi has talked about helping to bridge the gaps between Saudi Arabia and Russia, that there seems to be some tension between them, but that they're finding common interest in the vacuum that's been created or in the animosities that have been created. I think it is a mistake for us to cut stuff to Egypt now when they're fighting al-Qaeda in Gaza and they're fighting, trying to limit Hamas's operations in Gaza, rather, and al-Qaeda in the Sinai, facing real challenges. It doesn't mean we shouldn't press for human rights and all the other things that we should be dealing with, but I think it's like compounding the mistake we made with Mubarak, with how we handled Mubarak, and it's what leads Saudi Arabia to the conclusions that it reached and why it made this demonstrative act of not going to the Security Council was against as much a message to the U.S., as against the UN over Syria and Iranian policy.
And doesn't make any headlines here, and it's such an important story.
And remember, they were elected. This is not something that was that day's decision.
Right.
And they had people here at Columbia University for 3 months training for this. They it's a big deal. And the Arabs have this seat designated, and they rotate between the North African Arabs, and Morocco had it last, so it goes to the Asian Arabs, which is, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, UAE, Jordan. And I don't know who will take it. It could be that Kuwait will take it, or Qatar, which is certainly not better for us.
And finally, I hope that our listeners took our advice last week and saw some, and looked and researched and saw some of the photos of the enemy's tunnels that Hamas is responsible for in the Gaza area. The professionalism, the engineering that went into it, the time that was spent building them. I mean, for God's sake, you put those tunnels in Manhattan, what kind of real estate price you can get for them, the way they look?
It's 1.8 kilometers. It took a year and a half, 800 tons of concrete, tens of thousands of slabs of concrete. The whole roof, everything was covered, was tiled. There was electricity, telephone, other stuff.
Air conditioning, right?
And maybe at the beginning, I don't think that the whole thing was air conditioned, but they have wind blowing in it.
Right.
It was clearly meant to kidnap soldiers, and we don't know how many more. They just, in fact, found an extension of a tunnel they discovered last November.
I mean, Mayor Weingarten told me
explosives.
Mayor told me that it was built for two men across, that there was enough room for two-way traffic.
You could bring a battalion through this through this tunnel. The seriousness of it should never be underestimated, and the difficulty in detecting them. This was very far down, and so the surface detectors, detection systems may not have worked on it, and it is very serious, and it shows you that Hamas, which complains about not having enough concrete for their people, Israel is, in fact, the lifeline for Gaza today. because Egypt closed it off. Food comes from Israel. And yet they engage in this kind of activity, are proud of it, and say that they're going to start working on others. And the weakness of Hamas today, their financial and other things, doesn't stop them from making this the priority over feeding their people and doing what they should be doing.
All
those who put pressure on Israel and make all these demands, think about that.
Malcolm, this conversation will continue, please God, next week. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful show.
It'll be all good news next week.
I hope so. Please.
And everything will be all.
We're begging you. We're begging you. You have no idea. The listeners want to hear good news.
Mama Sarah is watching us this Shabbos, so it'll be good.
There you go. Nice Vart. I like it. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.